told all the story. Oh, can everyone hear me okay? Yeah? I told all the storytellers, get as close as you can without making out with the mic. So we're going to all try to do that. Hello, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to Maternal Health Storytelling. It's so great to have all of you here. Clap your hands if you've ever been to a yarn show before. Very loud clapping. This is my partner over here. So I'm like, okay, we got to take that into consideration. This project and the culminating event that you're about to watch really started back in January. I started working with one of my awesome colleagues, Omaya Jones, who is a yarn member, to start collecting stories on maternal health. The topic piqued my interest after I had a baby. Before I had a baby, I was a little bit older. I was what you will hear a little bit later, but they term very lovingly as geriatric. So I was a geriatric pregnancy. I was going to be a geriatric pregnancy. I knew that. I was a little bit later in life when I was overcome with a very fierce determination that I was going to be a mom. I knew it was going to happen, and I even thought blissfully that I could do it by myself. I say this with the most seriousness and the understatement of the century. I knew nothing. I knew nothing about how hard it was going to be on my body, on my relationship, on my physical health, my mental health. And I felt like I had all of the structures in place to help me. I had support. I had healthcare. I had a partner with a flexible job. And it's still... It was shattering in so many ways how hard it was. I love being a mom. I have a 3-year-old. He's wonderful. But the experience really opened my eyes to what I didn't know. And as I've talked to women through the past 9 months, it's become ever so clear that so many women don't know what they don't know. And it's shocking because we live in a society of information. And so I wanted to make sure that through this project, women's voices were centered. That was one of the big goals, to hear from the women trying to bring life into the world, to hear their stories. I wanted to create an event to educate people, not only people who knew nothing about birth or even had an interest in it, but the women who had gone through experiences that they thought were unique to them, right? Like, and felt isolated and alone. I wanted to create an opportunity so women could recognize their stories and other women's stories and really weave a network of support through Arkansas and hopefully in the South, right? And hopefully bigger than that, right? So tonight you will hear from, God, I'm just so honored to be a part of this cohort, 6 women who have worked so hard to hone and craft stories that really are a turning point in many of their lives. They are going to be vulnerable with you. They are going to share some of the most intimate details of their lives with you tonight. And that takes really great courage. And so I just want us to remind them how supportive we are tonight. So can we show them how supportive we are right now? You're going to hear a lot of themes, but you'll also hear a lot of similarities. So I'm really excited to get this show started. After our storytellers, we are going to have, very quickly, so there won't be a break, we're going to move right into a panel discussion with 5 experts working in the field of maternal health in Arkansas. So it's going to be a really informative and moving experience, and I'm so glad you're here tonight to support and to witness these stories. First up, we have Lisa Thorpe. Lisa is an artist and educator who leads workshops on the convergence of art and spirituality in interfaith, interspiritual, and secular settings. Please give a warm welcome to Lisa Thorpe.
Let me get this up, maybe. There we go. Can you hear me? When I was 16, I was about 5'2", flat as a pancake, and did not have my period yet. And I noticed, and everyone in high high school noticed, and thankfully my mom noticed. And she took me to a doctor and then to a specialist, and they started testing, doing blood work, doing ultrasounds and pelvic exams and hormones and mixing and stirring until they got the hormone special sauce just right. And 5 years later, after doing all those things month after month, sometimes every week, I ovulated once at the age of 21. And they said, great, go out, have fun, come back when you're ready to have a family. So I did. I had some fun, and I met my husband. And so 10 years later, I said, all right, we're ready to start a family. And I went back to those same specialists, and they got me on the hormones and doing the blood work, the pelvic exams, the sonograms. And this time, put an X on the calendar. That's when you're going to go home and have sex and then make a baby, right? So first time, no. Second time, no. Third time, no. Fourth time, say it with me, no. And that's when we got a letter from our insurance company. Looks like y'all are trying to have a baby. Have fun with that. We're not helping anymore. And my husband and I weren't ready to stop trying, so we had a fundraiser. I made some art, and we sold raffle tickets and asked everybody to come to a party at our house and bring things to put on our fertility shrine, little fertility goddesses and poems and candles and sweet cards. And we raised a whole lot of money, and everybody in the whole world knew we were trying to get pregnant. And so we started on that little hamster wheel again. Hormones, pelvic exam, ultrasound, X on the calendar. Fifth time? No. Sixth time? No. Seventh time, I went in. I was feeling good. Lucky seven. Laying on the table, she's got the sonogram, the ultrasound stick in there. She's leaning in at the screen and sighs and says, I don't think your follicles developed. They didn't burst. And why don't you give your body a rest for 6 months? Come back. We can think about doing a different plan. And so I left and sobbed horrible tears, told my husband. That night there happened to be a healing prayer service at my church, and this time for healing prayer, I didn't ask to get pregnant. I asked for prayers to just let it go, and went home sad but resolved to, you know, get my body back and figure out what was next. So I don't know, about 6-8 weeks later, I decided, you know what, I'm going to get in shape and I'm going to walk to work. So I started walking, and there's a little coffee shop on the way, and I'd get my little latte on the way, and a couple more weeks go by, and I start feeling really queasy in the morning with my coffee. And I'm like, well, what if I'm lactose intolerant? So I switched to soy lattes, and a couple weeks went by, and I did feel better, and I'm still walking to work and feeling good and healthy, but my pants were really tight, and my bra was really tight, and this is weird. I'm, you know, walking, and I'm no dairy, and I'm like, well, what if I need to exercise more? So my husband says, yeah, let's get an exercise machine. So now I'm, you know, exercise machine, walking to work, soy lattes, eating the kale. I mean, I was so healthy and feeling strong and feeling good and feeling like I'm getting my body back. And more weeks go by, and still the pants are tight. But I'm thinking, I think my husband even said, you know, that's just muscle mass, right? You know, so I'm like, yeah. But I was on a road trip with my sister, and I was telling her about the lactose intolerant and the muscle mass and the tight pants and everything. And she kind of turns to me like, well, what if you're pregnant? And I was like, oh, I can't believe you're saying that. You know I can't get pregnant. That's terrible. You're the worst sister ever. Oh. I'm just like crying these horrible, messy, snotty tears. And then I just don't speak to her the whole rest of the way home. But she had planted this little seed in my brain, and I just kept pushing it out. A couple of weeks went by, pushing it out. I'm doing walking, exercising, you know, doing it all. And it just kept rolling around. What if I'm pregnant? No, no, you know you can't get pregnant. You know you can't. Don't do this to yourself. You're crazy. So I decided, all right, to get it out of my head, I went to the pharmacy, and I got a pregnancy test, and I went into the bathroom. Boom. Pink X. Can't be right. That can't be right. I went to the pharmacy, got two different brands. Did it once again, plus sign. Waited till my husband got home, another plus sign. And then I still was not convinced. I called my doctor and said, is there some way with my crazy hormones that I would get a positive on a pregnancy test? And she was like, well, why don't you come in tomorrow and we'll see what's going on. We'll do some blood work. We'll do a ultrasound and a pelvic exam and check your hormone levels and see what's going on. So I climb up on the table like I've done 1,000 times before. She's got the sonogram stick out, and she's leaning in on the screen. And this time, whoosh, 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 and she pushes back that stool, opens up the door and yells, cancel the blood work. There's a huge baby in there. So there I was, 21 weeks pregnant. And healthy, very healthy. And, you know, what was it? Was this a miracle? Well, it was the hormones and the doctors, and it was the prayers and the kale and the soy lattes and the exercise and the unscheduled sex. That helped too. So that surprise was one of the best things that happened to me. And I guess the moral of the story, maybe I should listen to my sister. My mom, husband, and baby, who's 20-something, is back.
I love it. It's like if we get different brands of pregnancy tests, it's going to be different. I had somebody walk up to me when I was getting a pregnancy test once and was like, just get the cheap ones. They work just as well. And I was like, okay, thank you, random stranger. Yes, Lisa, thank you so much. Our next storyteller has been a friend of mine for a long time. She is not a stranger to the yarn stage. She has told a beautiful story before, and she is here to tell another amazing, powerful story. Joyven Benton, Dr. Joyven Benton, is a North Little Rock native who has also lived on both coasts. She is committed to standing up for what is right and serving as a voice for those who are often unheard. She believes every person deserves dignity and the opportunity to live their best lives. Please give it up for Joyven Benton.
So, I've always been a very ambitious, motivated person. I was taught that anything worth having is worth fighting for. And to always be persistent, give your best. And as a black woman, I knew that I couldn't just do 100%. I had to do 110%. And that was if it was school, work, career, life, whatever. And so I didn't view having children any differently. Even when I found out that I had adenomyosis and endometriosis, I didn't know much about the diseases, except that it caused debilitating pain and that it could make it difficult to have children. I Googled it. But I didn't let that stop me. I figured, oh, if I have a plan, and it'll work out. It'll be okay. And that's what I did. With the help of IVF, my husband and I were successfully able to get pregnant. I was so proud of myself. But the pregnancy was so hard. It was very difficult. I was in so much pain from the very beginning. And one ER visit, I got a nice surprise. I found out that I was having twins. So I was really happy, but also a little anxious because I learned that this was considered a high-risk pregnancy because of the twins, also because of my mature age or geriatric pregnancy, as they called it, and that I would have to go on bed rest eventually. And I thought, okay, well, I can get a plan. You know, I'll make this will work. You know, I can get maternity leave, and I'll use some of my other leave and FMLA. It'll be okay. I can go on bed rest and then have some time after the babies are born. But that plan was quickly thrown out the window when I learned that my job didn't have maternity leave. And so I had to make some tough decisions. I didn't know what to do. I started to panic because my husband and I had just bought a house, and I was like, how are we going to pay this mortgage? You know, twins are expensive. We have a lot of bills. What are we going to do? So I had to make some tough decisions. I thought, well, you know what? I'm not the first to have a baby or twins. If they can do it, I can do it. I can do this. And that's what I did. I kept going to work. But I let my job know how disappointed I was that they didn't have maternity leave, especially since it was led by women. But I kept going to work. I kept going to my doctor's appointments. And at every doctor's appointment, she would say, so when are you going to go on bed rest? Are you ready for bed rest? When are you taking leave? And even though my body was screaming, yes, now, you need to go on bed rest now, my brain was saying, not now, you still need to work a little longer. You need to get more time, more leave. You need to go a little longer. And that's what I did. I just kept grinding it out, kept pushing, kept giving my all. But to my job's credit, they did create a maternal policy leave, probably because of all the hell I raised about it. And so I never forget the day that my boss came to tell me that I had the maternal leave policy and that I would be the first to benefit. I can remember just feeling a sense of relief and just like, okay, now I can do this. I can go rest. I can do what I need to do for my babies. So this was a Friday, and I went home ready to get into bed and just rest. On Saturday, my mom comes over, and she looks at me, and she goes, you're not looking good at all. And I'm thinking, I don't feel well, but I haven't felt well the whole pregnancy, so, you know, it's no biggie. But, you know, moms know that mother's intuition. And so she says, no, we're calling your sister, who's a nurse practitioner, to come over and check you out. So she comes over, and she listens to me. She checks my blood pressure, and she's like, we got to go to the hospital now. So we rush to the hospital. I get to the hospital. I kept thinking, oh, my gosh, I really have to pee so bad, but I just couldn't go. And I remember them saying, okay, we're going to admit you, and you're not going to leave here until you have these babies. You know, they put a catheter in, and I'm thinking, okay, well, this is fine. I was 28 weeks, and I'm thinking, I can make this happen. I was a little happy because I knew a week earlier I found out that baby B had a congenital heart defect, and they said she needed to stay in as long as possible to have the best chance of life. And so I'm like, okay, I'm in the hospital now. This will be okay. So that next morning, I'm there. The neonatal doctors are coming in. They're checking me out, and they're saying these babies are really small. Baby B is under a pound. At this time, I'm starting to go in and out of consciousness. Like, I'm just not able to know what's going on. I'm blanking out. And I hear my doctor come in and say, you know, she's having preeclampsia. She's going to have to deliver these babies. And the neonatal they're too small. The neonatal doctors are then saying, you know what, the babies might die. My doctor's saying I might die. Now they're saying we all might die. You know, my family is on an emotional roller coaster. And I'm just kind of thinking, like, what is going on? Like, how do we get here? And at one point, my nurse, it was a black nurse, she comes in and she goes, what are we doing? Like, we need to go now. We finna deliver these babies. And she probably saved my life because they get me into the delivery room. She does the C-section. She gets out baby A. She's 2.5 pounds. She pulls out baby B. She's 1.11 pounds. I'm behind a curtain, so I don't see or hear anything. And I'm laying there, and the babies are out, but we're just still there. I'm like, what's going on? We're just waiting. So I look to the anesthesiologist, and I'm like, what's happening? What's going on? And he's like, well, we're waiting on the urologist. The urologist, he's like, yeah. So come to find out, when she goes to do my C-section, she cuts my bladder because my bladder is stuck to my uterus, the endometriosis. And so waiting, it feels like forever. And finally the urologist comes in. He stitches me up. You know, this was scary because we're like, I'm open. Anything could happen. I could get sepsis, and there's nothing we could do. So finally, they send me to ICU, and my baby A, Nia, goes to Baptist NICU, and Nyla is flown, baby B is flown to Children's Hospital, and where she spends 5 months in the NICU. Nia actually goes to Children's as well 2 weeks later. She spends 4 months. Nala goes back where she has open heart surgery at 9 months. So we spend almost the first year in and out of the hospital. And I think back and I'm like, what could I have done differently? You know, you blame yourself a lot. And I think about it, and I say, you know, I really wish that doctor would have said, it's time for you to go on bed rest. I was looking to her to be the expert, to know that I needed her to say, you can stop. You don't have to keep pushing. You don't have to keep going. But she did. She kept giving me options, and if you're giving me options, I'm going to keep doing what I do. Just keep pushing forward. I realized that research matters because I went to so many doctor's appointments and not once did they talk about the endometriosis and how it could affect delivery and the pregnancy and how it affects your body and our lives. There's not enough research on women's health issues. We need to know about how these issues affect us and best practices and medical practices. That matters. Policies matter. Policies have consequences. I needed that maternity leave so I could do what I needed to do for myself and feel like I had the option to take the rest. Policies matter because rest is not a privilege. Policies matter because rest is a human right. And no one deserves to have to earn rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Joyven. Our next storyteller is Shanna Graves. She is a mother, a lawyer, a community advocate, and she is interested in uplifting women and children in everything she does. Please, let's give it up for Shanna Graves.
first baby when I was 24 years old. I was as excited as I could be. I've been accused of being nonchalant before, but everything went as normal until I got to be about 5 months pregnant. I was about 24 weeks pregnant. I remember vividly going to the Oaklawn opening day. I'd never been to opening day, and I was kind of using pregnancy as an excuse to go and eat all the bad food at Oaklawn. So we go, we have a good time. I remember at the end of it, I felt bad. And I kind of thought, oh, well, I ate all this stuff. I've been standing up and walking all day. My ankles were about this big. And I thought, maybe it's pregnancy. So I go home to rest. I put my feet up. I'm feeling worse and not better. My ankles are not going down. So by Sunday, I have a massive migraine. So I call my doctor. They say, come in. So Monday, I go in. And they go, check my blood pressure, it's high. And she goes, have you ever had hypertension? I said, no. And so I have to give a urine sample. And she goes, I want to make sure you're not spilling protein. I've never heard that before. So she sends me home with this jug to capture my urine. And I'm like completely grossed out by this. And she's like, go home. She tells me how to do it. And she says, lay on your left side. Don't get up except to go to the bathroom. And don't get on WebMD. I guess luckily I felt bad enough that I didn't get on WebMD. So I go to work the next day before my doctor's appointment. I go to the doctor's appointment. They check my blood pressure. And she goes, did you drive yourself here? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, and she looks at the urine sample and she goes, okay, so you need to go to the hospital now. And at the time I lived, this is in North Little Rock. At the time I lived in Conway. And I said, well, I need to go home. She said, no, you need to go to the hospital. So off to the hospital I go. They, too, were alarmed that I drove myself. And I am just oblivious. I have no idea what's going on. So I'm diagnosed with severe preeclampsia, and I'm admitted. And they go, you will be here until you have this baby. And I'm thinking, absolutely not. Like, I need to go to work. I need to save money. I haven't done my nursery. I'm still in law school. And they're like, nope, on your left side until you have the baby. So I'm there, and I'm fussing, but I'm there. And unfortunately, things get worse instead of better. And so at 26 and a half weeks, I delivered my baby, Peyton, via emergency C-section. She weighed 13 ounces, and the doctors and nurses were amazed and said that they'd never intubated a baby so small. Miraculously, she lived for 2.5 weeks, but then we lost her to complications due to the severe prematurity. So we do all of those things. We have the funeral. Now I'm home. And this is when my crash course in postpartum care and what I now know to be called the fourth trimester began. I quickly realized that what we call postpartum care is very baby-centric, and I went home without a baby. So my family has gone home, my partner has gone back to work, and I'm just kind of, I'm off work, I'm not physically going to law school, I'm just at home trying to figure it out. So I'm just there, just like on the internet, Googling what causes severe preeclampsia, trying to figure out what I could have done differently, and just there. So I go to my 6-week checkup, and they do the postpartum questionnaire, which I probably scored off the charts where nobody batted an eye. I go through the routine checkup, and my doctor comes in, who was a woman and a mom, and she asked me 2 questions that I didn't expect. The first one was, how much are you eating? And I had to think about it before I could answer the question. And it wasn't until then that I realized I hadn't been eating very much. And then the next question was, are you sleeping? And before she could get it off her lips, I was like, no. And so I then learned about postpartum anxiety. I'd never heard that phrase before. I only knew postpartum depression or the baby blues and like the really dramatic expressions of that we see on television and not the ways that it often shows up in women. So luckily, I was able to get help, and I got through that time period. So fast forward 9 years later, I'm married, and after a long fertility journey, I am successfully pregnant. I have a very uneventful, high-risk geriatric pregnancy. You know, I'm full term. I have a smooth, scheduled C-section delivery, and then everything goes off the rails. When the nurses would come in to check on me, my mom goes, well, her blood pressure's a little elevated. And they're like, oh, she just delivered. And my mom's like, yeah, but she has hypertension. You know, we've been, and she's talking about my history. And they're like, oh, it'll be fine. So this goes on for a few days. They come in, they're like, Miss Grace, how are you feeling? I'm like, well, you know, this morning, like, I was blowing my nose, and I noticed clots. Oh, you had an epidural. It'll be okay. Miss Ms. Graves, how do you feel? I have a massive migraine. Oh, that's probably from the spinal tap. We'll bring you a Mountain Dew. So my baby becomes jaundiced. And so, of course, naturally, everybody's caring for him. They're taking him away from me. So breastfeeding goes off the rails, and his weight starts to drop. He's gaining weight, losing weight, gaining weight, losing weight. Everybody is concerned, naturally. But this whole time, I'm going, I don't feel good. I have a headache. My nose is bleeding. Oh, you just had a baby. You just had a baby. You just had a baby. So the last day we're there, I tell the nurse, I don't feel well. You just had a baby. You're not going to feel great. And I say, yeah, but I feel really bad. So I had my son in May. So this is pre-COVID. It's not flu season. And I'm telling her, like, I feel like I got hit by a bus. Like, I kind of feel like I have the flu. Well, you had a C-section. That's what it is. So a few hours later, we're dismissed. My baby's weight is still up and down. So I'm sitting home with the instructions, and breastfeeding is not going well. So I'm sitting home with the instructions to feed him every 3 hours, let him nurse, then feed, bottle feed him, then pump. And every hour that I'm not feeding him, I need to pump. And take him to the pediatrician every day until he is back at birth weight. So naturally, I'm getting no rest. So at about 3 a.m. that morning, I fed him. He's asleep again. My husband is asleep, and I'm hacking, coughing. So I think, oh, God, I have a blood clot. And I don't tell anybody. So we go to the pediatrician the next day, and from the car, like the handicapped spot at the pediatrician to the door, I'm about to, like, pass out. So I say something to my husband. He's like, oh, you've been up. You've been down. You know, when we get home, I'll take the baby, go to sleep. So I'm closed up in our room so I can rest, and I'm hacking. I'm just coughing. I'm just coughing. So the alarm goes off for me to feed the baby, and I say to my husband, you're going to think I'm crazy. Just go with it. So off to the urgent care we go. I tell the urgent care doctor this whole story. He goes, I hate to do this to you, but I really can't send you home without knowing for sure you don't have a blood clot. So I really need you to go to the ER. I'm going to call them and tell them you're on your way. I get to the ER. My blood pressure is like 217 over 195. My pulse ox is so high, the nurse described it as gasping for air. And so I'm immediately admitted for postpartum hypertension. They do all these tests and x-rays and confirm I have pneumonia. So the OB on duty comes in, and he's like, when did you go home? And I say, Monday. And he's like, yesterday? And I'm like, yeah. He's like 24 hours ago? And I go, yes. And he goes, did anybody check you for pneumonia? And I'm like, and he goes, he describes this instrument to me. I can't pronounce it. And he goes, did anybody have you blow into an instrument like this? And I say, no. And he's like, so I tell him the whole story. I just told you all about my experience with the nurses over that week I was in the hospital. He's so upset. And I try to defend it. I said, well, my OB was out of town. So somebody, and he's like, yeah, no. He calls my OB at like 10 p.m. on her cell phone, you know, to complain about how poorly I had been treated in her absence. I was cared for. I go home to my baby, and I'm back on the breastfeeding roller coaster. It's not going well. Luckily, I have a friend that I'm like texting and venting to and confiding in who's also a mom. My last text to her, maybe it's because it was at 5 a.m., I don't know, but she texts back and says, okay, so I'm going to take a lunch break today. I'm coming over there. I'm going to bring you food. I'm going to see the baby. She gets there. I'm in my living room in the dark with the blinds closed, with the baby in my lap, like watching Grey's Anatomy. So I left the door unlocked for her. So she comes in, like turning on lights, and she goes, hand me the baby. And I hesitate. And she says, I have 4 kids. I know what to do with a baby. And I go, and she goes, sit down and eat. And I go, well, I really want to take a shower before you go. Like, I can eat with him, but I can't. And she's like, or you can do both. I have time. So I go to do both. And when I come back from the shower, she has this box. And she's taken all of my breastfeeding stuff, including the pump, and put it in this box. And I look at her, and she goes, this is not good for you. Your baby is okay. He's fed. He's growing. But you are not okay. And you're still sick. So I want you to give me this. I want you to open the blinds. And please stop watching This Is Us in your postpartum period. So we move on. And I'm saying that to you all to say, you know, mom tribes are great. And I'm really thankful for my tribe of women who are both mothers and not. But that's not enough. I did not get what I needed during my fourth trimester. And I think that we really need more, like, resources and attention around mothers. We really need to start nurturing mothers as much as we nurture the newborns. You know, the fourth trimester, I would leave you with, the fourth trimester also belongs to the mother. And we all need to remember that. And before I take my seat, I'm going to say hello to my friend of 25 years, Kara Wilkins, who has held my hand through all of this journey. So thank you for coming.
Is Carol? Is it Carol? Is Carol here? Where? Where are you, Carol? Oh, Kara, where are you, Kara? Oh, hey, Kara. I didn't know this story was about you until just now. Wow. Oh, my God. Let's give it up for Kara. I swear, the people that have held these women's hands, we need to give it up for them, too. Our next storyteller has also held some hands. Annette Kudelek is our next storyteller. She is a native of Arkansas, of Little Rock, a mom of two boys, and she runs her own private practice as a dietitian who helps people heal their relationship with food. Please give it up for Annette.
This is a story. Can you all hear me? This is a story about what I jokingly refer to as the time that I completely lost my mind. But first, I'd like to tell you about my brother-in-law, Mike, who died by suicide at age 29. Mike was a bright light. He was warm, funny, popular. He had the best sense of humor. He had an amazing support system. He had all of the opportunities one could hope for in life. But none of that stopped him from taking his life when what we later identified was during a battle with schizophrenia and psychosis. Previous to this, I had never seen somebody quite literally lose their mind. Mike was in a different world, one where we could not reach him, no matter what we so desperately tried. I watched his family try and access every possible resource, but resources were lacking, and answers for Mike's suffering were not readily available. Mike took his life in his childhood home, while his parents upstairs in his bedroom, while his parents slept downstairs, unaware of his leaving. Mike suffered through some of the hardest and scariest days any of us here can likely ever imagine, and eventually it just became too much to bear. I think if you've never contemplated suicide, it's impossible to understand the level of pain one must be in to feel like death is your only option. Previous to Mike's death, I had always been very ambivalent about having kids. After Mike's death, the answer became so obvious that my husband and I texted each other on the same day saying, "Let's have a baby." The answer became so obvious because what mattered was love, family. Mike's death put everything into perspective. And all of a sudden, you know, after witnessing such a devastating loss of life, we wanted to bring life into the world. We both felt called to do that. We got pregnant quickly. A couple of months later, we were celebrating the news with my family and Tom's family. And I was experiencing the hell that is morning sickness. My birth was smooth as well, uneventful. Teddy was born on May 1, 2021, a couple of weeks short of the year anniversary of Mike's passing. It wasn't until about 48 hours after Teddy's birth that I began to experience the fear that would soon consume me. Due to when my water broke and the timing of Teddy's birth, I hadn't slept for about 48 hours. Although this slightly checked out, I mean, I'm in a hospital, after all, active labor, sleep is hard to come by, especially with a sweet little baby to stare at all day and night. It checked out, but I was also a little worried about it because I did have some opportunities to sleep, so I brought it up with my midwife at discharge. I brought up my concern about my lack of sleep, and she said, "You know, it's very normal in a hospital. That's not uncommon, especially for a new mom, but some women can go into psychosis, but treatment is available and it's rare." At that moment, in my exhausted and hormonal stupor, my brain latched onto that and said, "This is what's going to happen to you." I go home that day, that night, didn't sleep again. Teddy would sleep for a couple of hours at a time, and I would lay there, eyes wide open, growing increasingly alarmed by my inability to sleep. The next day, naps were out of my grasp as well. sleep when the baby sleeps, apparently did not apply to me. The fourth night after Teddy was born, sleep did not come again. I came downstairs with tears in my eyes, and my mom, shout out, who was staying with us at the time, said, "Annette, surely you must be dozing off at some point. You can't be laying there awake all night long." I reassured her, though, that's indeed what's happening. I'm laying there, eyes wide open, my stomach a tangle of anxiety, feeling like I'm just constantly about to be attacked by a lion all night long. So as this insomnia continued, I began to feel sick all the time. I couldn't eat much, so I had to start drinking my calories. I cried all the time in the arms of Teddy's pediatrician at his very first appointment, with my midwives when I would go see them for check-ins, with my mom while she held me in bed like I was 5 years old again, and with my sweet husband Tom every chance I could get. My anxiety knew the ending, and it was not good. So it, like any problem that needs to be solved, I turned to Google. Google and anxiety are best friends with each other. I don't know if you guys knew that. I spent a lot of time doom scrolling Google in those early days. I would type into Google questions like, how many hours can you go without sleeping before you die? How long can you stay awake before you die? Just totally unanswerable questions. But I was so desperate for an answer that I just kept searching, and it gave me a weird sense of comfort to doom scroll. I'm sure some of you have experienced that before. And then I remember one afternoon in particular, my in-laws got me in touch with a therapist that I could just speak to one day over the phone. And I remember telling her through tears streaming down my face how sad and scared I was that Teddy was going to grow up without a mom. I was so sure that this sleeplessness was going to kill me. I didn't know how that would happen, but I was so positive of that happening. And then finally, one afternoon, this was probably about 8 or 9 days, I would say, postpartum. So the time frame is really short. I was doom scrolling yet again in my basement, my dark basement. My eyes are all bloodshot. I'm just trying to stay alive and understand what's happening. And I came across a woman's blog. And in this blog, she detailed an experience relatively similar to my own. So I kept reading. At one point, she mentions postpartum anxiety, and it was like a light bulb went off. I was like, this is what I'm experiencing. Like, oh, I'm not dying from lack of sleep. I have postpartum anxiety, which is making me not sleep, which is making me feel like I'm dying. And that lifted such a huge weight off my shoulders, because the previous problem was, how can I get more sleep so I don't die? And I couldn't solve that, right? That was unsolvable. The new problem became about, all right, I have postpartum anxiety. This has happened to other women before. Treatment's available. This is temporary. Let's get treatment so I can start feeling better. That was a huge realization and a huge turning point for me. So that same day, I reached out to my team of midwives, and they took me seriously. And together, we formulated a plan that involved extra support with Teddy at home, a couple of different medications so I could sleep better and have less anxiety, and then reaching out to a therapist who specializes in postpartum mental health. So that same night, after picking up my new medication from the pharmacy, going back home, tossing Teddy to my husband so he could take over, and turning on Superbad for some comic relief, I attempted sleep yet again, and I got 2 hours. And let me tell you, the smile I had on my face the next morning when I came downstairs, I felt like things were going to be okay again. So over that next month, I gradually came out of it more and more. I started having more fun. I started sleeping as well as anybody with a newborn sleeps, which is not much, but it was better than it was before. And I started feeling that joy that the postpartum period can bring. And then, looking back at this, like, of course it was postpartum anxiety. You know, it seems so obvious, but similar to Shauna, at the time I had never heard of postpartum anxiety. I had only heard of postpartum depression, and those symptoms did not look like my own. So it makes sense that I didn't think that it was postpartum anxiety. In addition, you know, none of the people I had reached out to ever mentioned that, you know, as what I was dealing with. At the pediatrician, I filled out one of those postpartum mental health questionnaires. I'm sure I scored off the charts. No follow-up. Not my midwives, not my doula, not the therapist I spoke to that one day on the phone. Nobody could point this out and say, this is what's happening to you. They all seemed just as confused as I was. Maternal mental health conditions account for about 1 in 4 preventable maternal deaths. This is why I'm telling this story today. This is why this is important. I was lucky that, honestly, Google exists and that I found this woman's blog. I was lucky that I was able to diagnose myself because many women are not so lucky. In addition, I was lucky that I had the support that I had. Once we knew what was going on with me, you know, my family and friends and my community all came in to support me. And as a result of that, I was able to come out of that anxiety without any lasting physical or emotional damage. In addition, I was able to give birth to my second baby about 2 months ago. He's somewhere in the back. My husband's trying to keep him from screaming his head off because mom is gone. And I have not experienced postpartum anxiety the first time, and I cannot tell you how good it feels. And I 100% believe that this is all due to me being prepared this time. So being prepared with a plan, having the early support of my care team, and being on medication. The last 2 months have been some of the most amazing and joyful, bright days of my life, and to say that I'm grateful is an understatement. It's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay to not get help for not being okay when treatment exists simply because women are either not taken seriously or we don't know the signs to look for. Mental health conditions are not benign. They can have devastating consequences as evidenced by my brother-in-law Mike's story and the countless women who have lost their lives due to a mental health battle in the postpartum period. I don't tell this story to scare you, but I do tell it so that we can talk about it more, put words to it, and normalize it. Because if we can do that, I believe that prevention can improve, treatment can improve, and outcomes can improve, which ultimately means that lives are saved and less women suffer. Thank you.
Doing? I'm going to take a big breath. Whew, I feel like I've been holding my breath for the past hour. All right, we're breathing in. We have two more storytellers before our panel discussion. Are we ready? Are we ready? Yes? Yes? Okay. Our next storyteller is the fabulous Chantel Hinton Hill. She is an engineer turned pastor and scholar and writer whose work sits at the intersections of social justice, black feminism, and faith. She holds degrees in engineering and divinity and is pursuing her PhD in rhetorics, communication, and information design. And she is the author of Love Auntie, Parables and Prayers for Sacred Belonging. But perhaps her most joyful role is being a mom to her precious and spunky 2-year-old daughter, Sophie, who was at rehearsal last night. Sophie June is her daughter. Please join me in welcoming Chantel.
I can't hear nothing. Can y'all hear me? Okay. I know I got to spray it with my hand sanitizer because I'm not about to get sick. Okay. When I walked into the hospital to deliver my daughter, just after 3 a.m. on October 23rd of 2021, I was already trembling. I wasn't trembling because of nervousness due to impending motherhood, nor because we were smack dab in the middle of a global pandemic that had shuttered our healthcare system. No, I was trembling because just a couple of months prior, I had lost my stepdad, who passed away unexpectedly. And the last time I had been in a hospital was to say goodbye to him. His absence was heavy, grief setting on my chest like a stone I could not set down. And my mind went blank. Give me a second. That's why I have my phone. But even heavier than that grief was a truth that I carried. A truth that I carried before I stepped into the hospital. The truth is that Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than white women in the United States. I knew the math, and I knew the odds really weren't in my favor. So you can see, as I walked into the hospital, I carried more than just a hospital bag filled with blankets, binkies, and bottles. I also carried with me fear, complex trauma, grief, and that statistic that felt like a prophecy just waiting to be fulfilled. I remember walking into the hospital and asking myself, would I be another Black woman who did not walk back out again? So when the time came, I was seated in a room. It was extremely cold. Why they got these hospitals so cold, y'all? It was very bright, and it was overwhelmingly white. And to be clear, I'm not just talking about the walls. The anesthesiologist came in and prepped me for surgery, but my doctor wasn't there because, of course, my baby girl, Sophie June, had decided to make her debut a week before my scheduled C-section. My partner at the time was also not able to be with me because of the stringent COVID protocols. So I sat there alone, cold, as contractions were coming harder and closer together now. And my body began to shake. Of course, right after that, they said, we need you to hold still. They wanted me to hold still because they were going to insert this ginormous needle into my back. But I don't know how you can hold still when you're trembling with fear. I don't know how you can hold still when you're still holding on to the fact that too many Black women never came home. I'm a manuscript preacher, and so I never preach without papers, so this is, like, new to me. So it's cool, though. This is my story. It's good. Okay. So I'm sitting there. My fists are clenched. I'm holding my breath. Tears have filled my eyes, and my body is shaking. And as my body shook, I could feel my body, my whole being was telling me the truth. I am afraid of dying. Please don't let me die. Only nobody in that room could hear me. And then miraculously, there was Miss Connie, this woman that I hadn't seen in the room before that moment, a middle-aged Black woman dressed in scrubs. She was cleaning and tidying at the edge of the room, preparing the space for surgery. And I really didn't see her. She had been invisible until the moment that she stepped towards me. And she grabbed my arms, and she placed them on her shoulders, and she looked me square in the eye, and she said, baby, you gotta breathe, and I'm gonna stand here until you're okay. Her presence wasn't loud. It wasn't performative. She wasn't preparing to make an announcement. She wasn't even preparing to cut me open with scalpel. Yet her simple gesture cut through my fear with surgical precision. Her presence was cosmic. Her presence was purposed. Her presence was divine love in action, the kind of deliberate, life-saving love that Black women do for one another all the time. And in that moment, my fear melted away just enough for breath to return and for life to hold steady in my body. What Miss Connie gave me in that room was more than just comfort. She gave me a sense of deep belonging. Even in the sterile brightness of that operating room, she reminded me that I wasn't alone. even in the shadow of systemic neglect, she reminded me there's a tribe of women who will not let you go under the knife alone. And I have come to name what happened to me in that room as sacred belonging. In my book, I write about sacred belonging as a practice having four commitments: truth-telling, tribe, tears, and transfiguration. And each of these four commitments came alive in my birthing story. First, truth-telling. Truth-telling is not always about what our words say out loud. Sometimes it's about what our bodies remember and carry and remind us of and refuse to silence. After my daughter's birth, I remember standing in front of the mirror, unable to recognize myself. My body was marked and marred by survival, and as I stood there, all I saw was breast engorged with milk, a C-section incision that burned and screamed every time that I moved, and stretch marks that appeared across my skin like hieroglyphs. And I cried. I cried because I no longer recognized myself. I cried because that fear of dying was still living in my body. I cried because survival had remade me into somebody that I really didn't recognize. But here's the thing. My fears and my cries were a form of truth-telling. My body told the truth even when my mouth could not. It told the truth about what it means to be fractured yet still whole, to be terrified yet still standing, and to live when the odds say that you should not. The second commitment is tribe. How many of you all know that tribe can feel like a sanctuary? As has been said by so many of the storytellers tonight, Miss Connie was a part of that sacred tribe, that sanctuary. But so were the women who weren't in the room. My foremothers, my line sisters, my friends, the ones who held me in text messages, whispered prayers over me because they had already walked this journey before. Even in silence, they were present. Even in their absence, I could hear their voices singing the chorus, "You are not alone. We hold you and we got you." This is what tribe does. This is what sanctuary feels like. It doesn't erase the pain or the fear, but it does remind you that they are not yours to carry alone. The third commitment is tears. More specifically, tears as salvation. For too long, Black women's tears have been problematized or dismissed. We have either been told that we are too strong to cry, or our cries have been too inconvenient to be noticed. But in that hospital, my tears baptized me. They named the cost of survival. They washed away shame. They beckoned Miss Connie to come and see about me. They reminded me that grief is not weakness, that it is the evidence of love. Every tear that slid down my face was both protest and prayer. It was my body insisting, survival has a cost, but it ain't gonna cost me my life today. And finally, the fourth commitment, transfiguration. Over time, my body began to heal, but not into what it was before. I no longer asked to be the woman that I was before birth. I no longer look at my scars as something to scoff at or erase. Instead, I honor them as sacred text. I read my stretch marks as constellations of survival. I see my abdomen as an altar, a reminder that life passed through here, that love can sometimes be carved in flesh, and that resurrection oftentimes leaves a mark. This is the truth of transfiguration. Not pretending that wounds were never there, but that somehow they can be made into something new. But let me be clear. My story is not just mine. It is tethered to a national crisis. Black maternal mortality is not an individual tragedy. It is systemic. It's structural. It's what happens when racism, misogynoir, and neglect converge at the site of our wombs. And yet, within this crisis, Black women have and always will birth more than just babies. We have birthed visions of freedom. We have carried both glory and grief. We have insisted that even when the world treats our bodies as disposable, our stories will prove otherwise. So today, I invite you into this story. not as spectators, not as consumers, but as witnesses. Witnesses who will not let the statistics define our children's futures. Witnesses who will hold on to one another's arms, lift them up, and say, breathe, baby. I'm going to stand here till you're okay. Because this womb's work is not mine alone. It is not yours alone. It is the work of a community, of a movement, of a world struggling to be reborn. May we midwife that world together. A world where Black mothers live. A world where survival is a guarantee and not just a chance. A world where our bodies are not met with suspicion, but met with sanctuary. Thank you.
Our final storyteller tonight is Regina Taylor. Well, let me introduce her and then clap again. Regina is a daughter, sister, wife, and mom. Her personal mission is to build connection and serve within her community. Please give it up for Regina.
Martin Luther King Jr. Day, 2014. Oh, my husband and I had just been married a little over 2 years, and we were excited to learn that we were pregnant. Yes. Well, we were both working full-time, so we were able to access all of wonderful health care benefits. We went to the prenatal visits. We were following the doctor's orders. Everything was going smoothly until about the 21st week. Around about that time, I started having these symptoms. My back started to hurt. I was having like some cramping. And you all, I had some funky discharge. I didn't know what was going on. So I called my sister, who happened to be pregnant at the same time. She was pregnant with her second baby, my niece. And we were excited about being able to raise our children at the same time. I said, hey, are you experiencing any back pain, any cramping, any funky discharge? She said, no, I can't say that I am. But if you are, you should probably either call your doctor or just go to the hospital. So I tell my husband. We decide to go to the hospital. At the hospital, I'm checked in to the labor and delivery triage, and they're doing all my vitals, looking good. They put my son, of course, on my belly. They're checking his vitals. He's looking good. Everything's fine. I told the nurse, though, I said, hey, I was having this pressure and then also this discharge. And so she does, you know, a pelvic exam just to make sure everything's looking good. She said, nope, looks good, Miss Taylor. It's probably just, you know, new mom jitters. I said, oh, okay. So we're discharged and we go home. Well, I end up going to work. So I go to work and I'm just, you know, working. My supervisor sees me and he says, hey, you don't look so good. You should probably go home and rest. I said, okay. I go home. I'm like, I'm going to try to rest. I'm going to call my sister again. So I call my sister. I said, hey, I just got, you know, sent home from work. And she said, okay. You could call your doctor, or they have this, I just found out about this, like, emergency line or kind of non-emergency line. You can call and you can talk to like a doctor and they can just tell you what to do. I said, okay. So I call the line and I get the on-call physician. I said, hey, I'm having these symptoms, back pain, I'm having a little cramping, having this discharge. He was, oh, hold on, I'm looking at you. You were just in the hospital. I said, yes. He said, well, I mean, if you're struggling to tell me what's going on, then I really can't do anything for you. I said, oh, okay. But if you feel bad, just call your doctor. I said, okay, call my doctor. All right. It was around the Memorial Day holiday, so there are a lot of clinics and things closed. And so when it became that Tuesday after the Memorial Day, I called my doctor's office and said, hey, I'm not feeling well. You know, I said, my back is hurting. Do you all have any appointments today? Oh, Ms. Taylor, so sorry. We are jam-packed. There are no appointments today. I said, okay. Do you have any appointments tomorrow? She said, no. We have no appointments tomorrow. Okay, I'm gonna try to rest. Because, you know, maybe it's just new mom jitters. And so she calls back and says, wait a minute, Ms. Taylor. We do have, what we're going to do is the doctor is going to see you over his lunch break tomorrow. So we can get you at 12 o'clock tomorrow. Just be here at 12 o'clock tomorrow. I said, okay. That evening, now it's about 9:30, my husband and I are watching a basketball game. My back is hurting, and so I get up to use the restroom. Only I didn't have to use the restroom. Something broke. On May 28, 2014, I delivered my son, Kevin Reginald Taylor Jr., in my bathroom. He was 22 weeks. In my panic, I called to my husband, call 911, the baby is here. They send two ambulances, one for me and one for KJ. They send me to Baptist. They rush KJ to Children's Hospital. That night, while I'm admitted into Baptist, I kept getting the questions. Ms. Taylor, did you receive any prenatal care? Yes. Did you have any indication something was wrong? Yes. Okay. Well, we'll try to figure out what's going on, Ms. Taylor. You know, it's been the holidays, so your doctor's out of town. He's on his way back. Well, at that time, my husband was going back and forth between Baptist and Children's, checking on both me and KJ. And we're getting updates all the time from the NICU. Oh, he's doing great. He's doing great for his size. He's doing great. We rest. The next morning, my best friend has now come to the hospital. We're talking and chatting. We realize, you know, we had gotten an update about KJ. How is he doing? I call the NICU at Children's. And I say, hey, I'm Ms. Taylor, checking on baby Taylor. They say, oh, Ms. Taylor, his heart is failing. I immediately get off the phone. I yell to my husband, go to Children's now. I don't want him to be alone. Go. I don't want him to be alone. And so we're waiting on the doctor, and I told my best friend, hey, we got to get out of here. I wanted to take a shower and everything, and before we could even get the bag and all of that, my husband calls me back. And before he can say anything, I hear the monotone beep. He didn't make it. How could this happen? We did everything we were supposed to. We met in college, you know, we fall in love, you get married, you build a home together, you get pregnant, we're working, we do all of these things. How could this happen? I tell this story because I never want this to happen to another family. You know, during that time, they'll say, Ms. Taylor, you know, Black children are resilient. Black girls, when black girls are born, they have the highest rate for infants. I didn't want to hear that. I needed someone to tell me and listen to what I was trying to say. What happened to my son? I did everything I was supposed to do. I wanted to hear that someone was listening to me and not dismissing what I had to say. While this story is not necessarily about race or ethnicity, we know that all too often, women, women of color, women in rural communities, black women, are often dismissed. They're often ignored. And I never want that to happen to anyone else. I don't want a family's joy to turn into fear, sadness, or frustration. But the story does have hope. Hope for tomorrow. About a year later, we find out that we are pregnant again. And this time around, I have all the attention. I have two doctors. And I even see a specialist in my third trimester. And surprising to a lot of people, we decided to keep the same practitioner. Well, why would you keep the same provider? Because we wanted him to learn a lesson too. Too often, we are dismissed and ignored. What I want for everyone to hear tonight and to share this story, because as mothers, we deserve to be heard. Mothers, speak up. Practitioners, listen. Moms, it doesn't matter what it is. Whatever question you have, frustration, anything, you can ask that question. Don't be afraid. Don't fear. Because after all, we know our bodies better than anyone else. Thank you.
Audience, please give it up for all of our storytellers coming back on stage. Let's give a nice round of applause for all of our storytellers. Amazing, powerful, wonderful. Thank you so much. We are now going to move into our panel discussion. We have some amazing experts in the field of maternal health here with us tonight who are going to have a conversation and really try to unpack some statistics that go with what you just saw and what you just felt. So I'm going to have my assistant help me with some chairs. I'm going to bring these panelists up by name. First, we have the fabulous Ashley Bearden Campbell with Arkansans for Improving Maternal Health. She's our moderator tonight. We have Zenobia Harris with the Arkansas Birthing Project. We have Dr. Nirvana Manning with UAMS. We have Camille Richaud with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. And last but not least, we have Sandra Rodecker with the Doula Alliance of Arkansas. Come on up. And I'm going to give this to our moderator, the fabulous Ashley, and I'm going to get you one more mic.
I am a little bit at a loss for words after these stories. Just can't explain how amazing it is to see the courage and bravery of all of these women willing to share these incredibly personal and life-changing stories. So just thank you so much. I think that you just can't imagine what just hearing that type of thing, knowing that you're not alone in that, how that affects other people. So thank you all so much for being here and for your willingness to share your stories. While we're waiting for the other mic, I will not make everyone talk or listen to me, so I'll just pass this along. Obviously, Arkansas is experiencing a maternal health crisis. We've been talking about it for a few years now. what I want to know is, this is a storytelling event. So from each of your perspectives, how do these stories shape how we, or how should they shape how we approach the maternal health crisis here in Arkansas?
Hi there. My name is Nirvana Manning. I am an OBGYN by trade. And I mean, I guess to answer, so I've been practicing now, this is going to date me a little bit, close to 20 years after residency. So my career has definitely seen some changes. And I will say a large part of the work we do now is trying to make sure stories like this are heard by all the right people. I think it's so much more powerful. We train the next generation of physicians, right? So they come out of med school super eager to learn, but what they don't know are the stories. What they don't know are the patients. They know the pathophysiology. They know the drugs. They know how to treat this disease, but they don't know the stories, and they don't know how to listen yet. And so it takes bravery like this, and it takes stories, and it takes those patient encounters for them to develop that. And I think that's especially true in my field. It is a field of having to listen to people. And no two people come in with the same story, and no two people have the same pregnancy. I mean, I have three children. Not one of those was the same. And so kind of taking that aback in the midst of all kind of the messy things that are going on in healthcare and everywhere else, and stopping and kind of listening. And I think that's what we hope that we are also teaching kind of the next generation of doctors.
I love talking about storytelling. Also, if I sound a little bit like a coal miner, it's because the ragweed's personally trying to ruin my life right now. So I'm Camille. I'm the Health Policy Director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, where we do a lot of storytelling work as part of our advocacy. We work in that arena from grassroots to policy advocacy, and a lot of our work is about connecting the head and the heart. So we can throw all day really good data at you, good statistics, solid evidence, but none of that matters if we aren't also putting a face to those issues. We also have a good ground game around the state where we don't decide what's important. We want to hear what's important. So over the last year, we did maternal health focus groups around the state where we went all around the state with different groups of women, different demographics, different special populations from the Marshallese community, who actually most recently had the highest maternal death rate in the state, and from women getting substance use treatment who have been impacted by that, from the Delta to Little Rock. And we asked, you know, what's it like? What could have been better? What went well? And we got a huge, you know, diversity of perspectives from everywhere from the clinical encounters to logistics of travel to discrimination to, you know, just those care experiences. And that informs the work that we do. So the numbers are important because they help prove what you're hearing in the community. So our storytelling work is invaluable to us.
Hi, my name is Zenobia Harris. I am Executive Director of the Arkansas Birthing Project, and I have the privilege of working with women across many communities of Arkansas who are volunteers in their local community who provide support to women during pregnancy and for the first year of life of their babies. And ultimately, often, we become friends, and we become lifelong friends. My first little sister, we call our the women that we support little sisters, we became connected 25 years ago, and we're still friends. And now she's a grandmother, and I've had the privilege of supporting her daughter and her grandbaby as well. So it's very sacred, the work that we feel like we do, and it's akin to creating additional family links for people in this age and time where many people don't have that kind of support. They don't have their grandmothers or their great aunts or people with a lot of wisdom and life experience to support them, or just somebody just to listen sometimes and treat them special. We've had women tell us nobody's ever treated them that special before, checking on them just to make sure they're okay, asking questions. And that's the important part about this whole thing that we've got to keep in perspective when we're talking about providing care and support to people. Medical care is amazing. It's wonderful. We have the best technology in the world. But if we lose sight of the human factor, of the need to be supported, to be acknowledged, to be recognized, then our battle is not going to be won.
Hi, I'm Sandra Rodocker, and I am one of the board founding members of the Doula Alliance of Arkansas. I have had the privilege of serving families in this state for almost 13 years now. And it started out as being a breastfeeding peer counselor for the WIC office. I was a WIC mom. I was a Medicaid mom. So a lot of the stories that you hear when people are talking about not feeling as though they're being heard, they are real stories. And it's not a discount to any individual provider. It's a broken system, and we're just trying to find our way through it. And so I have learned in so many years that moms really just need to know that they're doing a good job. I can't tell you how many have told me no one has told them that they were doing a good job. And it's just that simple. It's as simple as opening your ears up and actually looking them in the eye, listening to them, and saying, you know what, this really sounds hard. They don't always want advice. Sometimes they just want to be heard. And then ask, what can I do to help? How can I get you a resource? If I can't find it, I will find somebody who does. And through all of these experiences with these families, they keep coming back. They reach out to other people. They bring their friends to postpartum support groups. They walk their babies down the street with their neighbors. They become a little less reclusive because we kind of hold that postpartum side in, and we're like, we got to keep the baby in a bubble. It's all about the baby. I heard several moms talk about how it's all about the baby. It's never about the mother. And sometimes we have to mother the mother. And it's really been a privilege and an honor to do this with so many great doulas in the state. Because if you've never heard of what a doula is, or you don't really know what a doula is, we're really pretty fabulous, to be quite honest. So, and doulas need doulas, so we're there for each other, too. So find a doula just to be a friend with, because they honestly are life-changing in so many ways, and I don't say that with bias. I really say that from experience.
I have a whole collection of doula friends now, I feel like, at this point.
So a lot of the stories that we heard tonight point to the heart of the maternal health crisis, which is access and equity. Arkansas is a rural state. We cannot change our geography, so some of those obstacles are not something that we can fix. But we also know that there are racial disparities. Camille, where do you see the biggest gaps between what families need and what the system is providing?
So I'm going to talk about healthcare and coverage. It is a little bit of my stump speech right now. It's my greatest hits right now. And I know that coverage is only half of the battle, that access matters, but we're talking about disparities. We're talking about who gets care, who doesn't get care, the type of care that they're getting. You can look at the Maternal Mortality Review Committee's report. It's been noted many times how black women are dying more than twice as frequently as white women in the state, and it's 2.5 times for Marshallese women. There is these gaps both in the cultural competence of providers, the recognizing what is needed from every point in getting coverage and maintaining coverage. And I know that, like, me up here talking about insurance after, like, the most heart, like, wrenching stories is a little strange. But in a state where 40% of women are losing insurance coverage who have Medicaid, which finances the almost the majority of births in the state, when women whose bodies haven't finished healing in a state where racial disparities exist in our outcomes, it's just unconscionable that they're losing access to the necessary care that can keep them alive. And it's why we harp on it over and over. So I know that there are different perspectives on racial health disparities, on the every part of the medical system, from the interpretation of labs to the clinical care setting. But I'm trying to get people in the door, and the reality is that there are racial disparities in who is losing coverage and who isn't.
So, Dr. Harris, obviously you are doing incredible work at the Arkansas Birthing Project. You have some really innovative programs. How can programs like your sister friend, how can those be scaled statewide? How can other organizations build upon the models that you've created?
Well, I think we certainly have the capacity in our state to for people to have sister friends or someone like that in their life if they want that, if they need that. I think we just have to decide that that's going to be an approach that we think we can implement in our state as we're implementing all these really amazing changes in our maternity care system, because some really amazing things have happened this past year with coverage, additional coverage, through changing the reimbursement rates for physicians so they get reimbursed more for serving people, particularly on Medicaid, because Medicaid pays for about half of the births in our state. Changing opportunity for people to get access to care through telehealth, that kind of thing, which would help in many communities where there aren't physicians available or sometimes delivery locations available for them in their local communities. But most communities in our state, every community in our state has community champions in those places, in our counties, people who know people who advocate on behalf of those who don't have or don't or need support. Every community has these people, black and white, in our communities. And so we need to figure out a way that we as a state can utilize that championship, that power that we have in our communities of these community champions to help us develop systems of support so nobody goes through pregnancy without somebody checking on them to make sure they're okay. And I'm not talking about going to the doctor okay, but that's important as well. But everyone should have the opportunity to have someone in their life who is concerned about them and who's willing to listen to them and to advocate for them if necessary, just like many of our storytellers talked tonight about their experiences and how they checked in with someone else who helped them make some decisions or tried to assess their situation. There are people who don't have sisters or people like that in their lives. And people find that difficult to believe, but it's the truth. It's the truth. And so we need people like that. We need to harness that power, that concern that we have in our communities to help improve our maternal health. So we need to have a whole campaign about harnessing the support in our communities to improve maternal health.
You touched on so many other things that I wanted to cover. But no, you're right. There has been so much innovation over the last year, even outside of policy, which I absolutely want to get to, and I would really want to hear from each of you on that topic. But before we get to that, Dr. Manning, UMS serves the entire state. You guys are doing incredible programs. The baby take-home box, I was so excited when I got to tour the vans, or the mobile. Yes, the mobile units. There's just so much innovation. What do you see is the next step for UAMS?
And just for anyone that's kind of not in the know with regards to some of the things,
Though it's devastating that Arkansas is number 50th in maternal mortality, it has brought attention and some grant funding that would not have been available otherwise. And so it's given us an opportunity to try some things. I think we've touched upon the fact that Arkansas is such a rural state. And though sometimes when you live in central Arkansas, you don't see that, all around the outskirts of our state, you may have to drive an hour and a half to get to a prenatal care visit. This also doesn't mean you're low risk. I mean, quite often there's such health disparities in these rural areas, they're significantly higher risk. So quite often they may actually need to come significantly more often to a doctor. And I could get into the myriad of reasons and transportation and working and families and all the things that are so difficult to navigate with that. And so with this, with some of the innovation that we've done is taking that care to them. There's a lot of work being done on mobile units, taking care to them. Also, there has been a recent grant that we received that is the kind of baby kits. And we started an Arkansas Center for Women's and Infants Health. And kind of the way I think about this, I want it to be an umbrella organization with which we can advocate for women from puberty all the way through menopause. But some of the things that we're doing, and one of the things I'm the most proud of, is a proactive postpartum call center. So that we call every single delivering patient in our state between 7 and 10 days postpartum. We go through some healthcare questions. We also go through some social determinants of health. Do you have diapers? Do you have formula? Do you have some of the necessary living things in addition to mental health? And then we ask them about insurance. We are the only state that does not have 12 months of postpartum care under Medicaid. And so I know it's my story right now too. So we're the only ones that don't do that. And so Medicaid coverage ends at 60 days postpartum or the end of that month. And so those women do not have access to preventative care. They do not have access to contraceptive care. And they do not have access to mental health care, which are the three top things that plague us in this postpartum period. And so with this proactive call center, we ask them if they have Medicaid and if they need help with the reapplication process. And if so, we get some community health care workers that are in every single county in this state, and we have 75 of them, and we help them with that process. And we hope that with this data, we will see significant improvements. And rather than put the burden on patients to call for help, we're kind of taking it off their plate and asking and calling them proactively. So I think there's a lot of work being done that I think we should all be real proud of. I mean, I do think the last legislative session was a huge win for women in our state. I mean, I always want to do more, and so I feel like I'm constantly looking at loopholes and ways that we can improve it. But I'm super hopeful that some of the things that we are doing will truly improve the health care for the state.
So that's exactly what I was going to talk about next. Like you said, we had a landmark year for policy in Arkansas. I think so many people in this room worked really hard on a lot of this legislation. I'm sure there was also a lot of disappointment on things that didn't pass, like postpartum Medicare expansion, but there is 2027, so we will not stop. But I'd like to hear, especially from you, Sandra, how did the doula legislation, how has this impacted how the general public understands what a doula is, what they do, and how is this going to expand access for the everyday Arkansan?
Yeah, so we had a huge legislative win this year. We were able to create a pathway to certification for community certified doulas, so that way Medicaid can provide reimbursement for doula services and private insurances have a pathway for insurance reimbursement. So that was really, it was work of the heart. By so many means, there were so many faces that we met along the way. Excel by 8 held our hand through all of this because we have never been in a legislative session, let alone asking for them to, like, pay for our services. So because, you know, for the longest time, doulas have been seen as a luxury. And as much as we can still believe that, we actually really aren't a luxury, especially in the state. We are kind of a necessary part of the solution in fixing the problems that we have going on here. Why? Because we have more of a peer-centered perspective and relationship with patients. We know the physicians, the providers. We can often be like, that doesn't really sound like your doctor, like in our heads, obviously. So, like, we can get more information to find out what is going on. Maybe someone misunderstood something. They're having a hard time deciphering that information. And we get to work with people that never dreamed that they would have a doula. And, like, that is monumental. And I don't want to cry.
Cry. You can.
Being a mom who gave birth to both of her sons on Medicaid in the state, had I had a doula, I might not have had postpartum depression. I still would have had hyperemesis because doulas don't have magic wands. But my postpartum depression was so isolating that I know that there's going to be so many people that are going to see their way on the other side of this. Just because we get to do our jobs and get to do what we do best, and we get to do it alongside of these amazing people that have that same goal. And so that was a win. I hope I answered that for you.
Absolutely. Perfect.
So,
is there anything else that anyone wants to highlight that you feel like was a really big win, obviously for Arkansas moms, but something that was a passion for you and your organization specifically?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. No, just like as a little historical context, I first started doing maternal like storytelling work in 2018, which was the year I met Dr. Harris. We were going around on a road show doing maternal health, just mostly working with Black and brown women who had experienced racism. I talked to women who, while incarcerated, had been shackled during labor. The Dignity Act made some changes around that. So there was like a win there, not this past session, but before. So I, even though I am hyper-focused on what we need to change, I do try to keep that. And at the time, I remember meeting doulas for the first time and first hearing, like, you know, Medicaid doesn't cover doulas, and I didn't know what a doula was. And now here we are a couple years later. And now we have Medicaid coverage for doulas. One of the ones that advocates had been working on since the 2023 legislative session was presumptive eligibility, which is basically fast-tracking Medicaid applications if you're pregnant. So the federal government requires Medicaid applications to be processed in 45 days. That does not happen if there's a backlog, and we know that there's often a backlog and a lot of administrative hurdles. So we were having women who were like waiting for their first appointment, and they're in their second trimester, and they're going on, and they cannot get care. And so that was a win. That was part of the Healthy Moms, Healthy Babies, like large bill that we had seen a win. So whereas we have a long way to go, like grasping onto all those wins, and that's one of them.
Okay, maybe instead of asking you what your best win was, if you could make a bold statement policy-wise, if you could ask the legislature to make one bold statement for Arkansas moms from the policy perspective, what would it be for you, Dr. Manning?
I know, that's a hard one because I feel like I want to. But I feel like since I've already said, I mean, again, I think extension of postpartum Medicaid for 12 months would just be life-changing for so many women, to give them the time to kind of get their breath, get their feet underneath them, and then start the reapplication process. But I think paid leave for our moms would be a huge one. So, I mean, it almost doesn't even discriminate. I mean, we have all the way from the CEO of our hospital down to, you know, people that are not skilled in medical care, the leave is horrendous. Quite often you have to be there for a certain amount of time. There's just so many caveats. I serve as the chairman of the department of OBGYN. And so even my physicians that come to me, if they come and they were pregnant when they chose to become faculty, I mean, the leave is the same as it is for anyone else, which is absolutely nothing. And so you're forced to take not paid leave. You're forced, it's a no-win solution. And while I think 6 weeks would be a huge win, I still don't even think that's enough. I mean, I think back on my own postpartum period, I don't know that I could see straight at 6 weeks. So we're asking women to go back to work and be, you know, productive in society after 2 weeks of giving birth. It just seems crazy to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's insane to make a mother choose between bonding with her baby or paying for her bills. And then we wonder why we're also experiencing a mental health crisis and all of the anxieties that come with that, the pressures. I mean, if she has a support system, maybe she could lean on that. The child care issue, I mean, we could, for the sake of time. Yeah. but to your point, I mean, this is not just a mom issue. This isn't just a baby's issue. This is a family issue. It's a community issue. It's a workforce issue. How can organizations like ours work together to tackle some of these things with a unified front and work with the legislature to get these policies passed? Like you had talked about, you know, this was the Doula Alliance's first time, and you needed some help there. I know that Camille and I, we've been working with our policymakers for a long time. I know you have as well. So, I mean, what do you think are some of these collaborative efforts that we can do to really make our case to the legislature between now and 2027?
Certainly, I think we need to have a plan.
Yeah. I think we need data. I mean, I think it's very data-driven. And I think there's data out there. And, you know, for me, I don't
– maternal health is a bipartisan issue. It doesn't matter where you sit on the spectrum. I feel like it's close to home. It shouldn't fall on party lines. And we need data. And so I am hopeful that some of the work that we are doing now will give a lot of that data. You know, to your point, resources. There's resources in our state, some of which are underutilized, some of which we don't know about, that don't have great access to. So we need good data to support all of that, and we all kind of need to collaborate where that comes to.
I think we need to be equal partners, too. I think it's important to listen to all the voices, all the different groups that are providing support so that we understand the unique situations and perspectives that they have and the contributions they can all make to help improve this problem. Because it's not, like I say, it's a multifocal problem. It's not just one and done kind of thing. So I think we need to be equal partners, equally respected, equally listened to, equally included in the planning and the implementation of whatever plan we come up with.
I'm all about moving to a system that is less reactive and punitive to a system that is proactive, holistic, and compassionate. And one of the things that sometimes frustrated me during some of our maternal health work is there were not enough moms in the room discussing it. Not the phrase, nothing about us, without us, I'm not a parent, but I don't get to decide what moms need, and too often there are decisions being made where you're not including the most vulnerable people, so any of those coalitions need to be, centering the needs of the most vulnerable women and moms in our state, and we all have our niches. We all have our, you know, at Advocates, we're the data nerds and the storytelling nerds. We've got the doulas who are there on the ground doing work, and we all need to figure out how we can be supporting each other's work and that being really reciprocal, building trust, building really good communication streams is also what I think about.
I think we have to really also identify the other groups that have the passion that we do for this, because there's several out there that I didn't even know existed and were trying to work towards the same thing. We have to find a way to make it personal for people to realize, like, this is impacting real lives. You know, some of the stories people hear and they think, oh, that's the rarity, but it's like, it's not the rarity if we've seen it more than once. And if it is, the one is just bad enough. So we have to find a way to make that story personal for somebody who can help get the message to the people that are making these decisions for all of us without us in the room. And sharing your stories over and over and over again, because there is power in normalizing what you have gone through to a degree of where people don't look at it and go, oh. Like, we look at it and we go, whoa, that, no, we can't do that. Like, this is what we should be doing. So we have to share that side of our experiences. When we have the support, sometimes it's hard, and I understand that, but being able to identify those people that are working with others, like, if you had an experience that your organization would be a great opportunity to see, call them and say, hey, is there anything I can do to help you? Like, I would love to volunteer. Like, you guys made such a great impact in my life, and I would love to just, like, make phone calls for you guys or identify places. Calling UAMS, like, finding out what organization. I didn't know that the Arkansas Women's and Infants Center was a thing. So sorry. But, like, what? I'm like, puberty to menopause? Like, yes, because that is another key factor, is the fact that, like, none of us really know what our bodies are meant to do. And that's a key piece of that education and working together to make sure that that information is shared with everyone.
Instead of talking about just maternal and child health, it needs to be maternal, child, and men's health or father's health as well, because they, well, that too, absolutely. Hey, he knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's talking about. But men are left out of this discussion, and they're a 50% part of this discussion. They make a huge contribution to the whole baby-making process. So I think it's very important that they're included in this. Something we've tried to do is try to get fathers' clubs where we get men involved and just talking to men and supporting each other through this whole experience. But I think the value that men can bring to enhance this discussion would be immeasurable. So it's something we really need to consider also as we're looking at this. And the other thing is, in reaching these families, we need to do these things at times other than 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Because people are at work and they can't take off work. So we need to do these things if we want to really include women and men in this discussion, the everyday average person who's experiencing whatever. We need to create opportunities and space for them to be able to do it at their convenience.
I love that. Something that Nicole Fletcher said earlier today was regarding men in this equation is, I mean, you were 50% of the conception part, you're going to be at least 50% of the postpartum part. So, yeah, exactly, it's a partnership, so you're exactly right. Obviously, we have so many more challenges that we could discuss. We have, I think, about 5 minutes left. So, knowing that we have power in our future collaboration, if we can come back together for the same panel in, let's say, 3 to 5 years, what progress do you hope to see?
Well, I think we could be better organized. Like you mentioned, there are many organizations that are out here in our state providing maternal and child health support, and we don't know each other. We need to make a real effort. Perhaps Arkansas Advocates could help us get together, convene opportunities for us to discuss what we're doing, share what we're doing, and form some kind of association that's a little different than what's been in existence so that we can benefit from all the resources. We've got amazing numbers of resources. How can we better, more effectively use it for the people in our state?
I would like to see the Maternal Mortality Review Committee not say that 94% of those deaths were preventable, because that's what last year said. 94% of those deaths were preventable. I want it to be zero deaths were preventable. And I want it to be zero deaths. I want it to be not the most dangerous place to give birth in the nation. I want us to start looking holistically about, from a reproductive justice approach to our entire reproductive reproductive lives from evidence-based sex education to, safe birth spacing, contraception access to postpartum care, and to creating environments where people can choose whether or not to raise children and to raise those children in safe and healthy and thriving communities. That's a tall order, but I'm an ambitious person, so. Yeah. And we got 5 years to do it, so.
I love that. I would love in 5 years if, again, that we were at the top, you know, that they said, wow, look at all the efforts that Arkansas put into this. Look at all the people that came to the table and cared enough, and look at how their trajectory has changed, and what can we as other states now learn from them. Like, that would be such a win, I think.
In 5 years, I would love to see more certified nurse midwives as part of normal care, because they can take care of our low-risk patients, so our physicians can spend more time with our high-risk patients, because our physicians are tired. They are running from one end to the other, and CNMs are a really good answer to a part of that solution. And I would love to see doulas regularly welcomed into the hospital continuously. Like, it's just a normal part of, you're having a baby, who's your doula? I think that needs to be the norm. And then we know who they're going home with, because we sometimes go home with these people. So they know that we're going to call and say, hey, we need to get this person back to someone. So I want to see that standard of care change a little bit, so we can let our physicians do what they do best, and then we can let our low-risk patients birth in peace, so to speak. And you know, Dr. Manning can maybe have a little bit of a break.
I want to see Dr. Manning get a good vacation whenever we've solved all these problems.
I know. I mean, I think we just need to wrap around our families in this state. And it's not just physicians. It's not just nurses. It's our doulas. It's our community health care workers. It's utilizing our county health departments. It's utilizing all the members that are there to make sure these families know they're not alone and that we're listening to what they're saying.
All right, let's give another round of applause for our panelists. Thank you all so much. Bear with me for just a few seconds. I have a few people to thank. I want to thank the rep for having us. I have names. Tamara Patterson, Will Trice, Angela Delaney, and Frank Mott. Thank you all so much for having us here. This space is amazing. I want to thank our sponsors, Arkansans for Improving Maternal Health, Arkansas Strong, Excel by 8, Arkansas Black Philanthropy Collaborative, and Arkansas Blue Cross Blue Shield. Yes, please, give it up. I want to thank Allison Pittman Gatman and Ashley Bearden Campbell, who really have helped me navigate getting this event together. Let's give a round of applause for them. All the amazing people who came out and tabled so that you all would have resources to take home, let's give them a round of applause. Two amazing men. I want to thank Omaya Jones, who's up in the sound booth, who helps get this podcast on the air. Thank you, Omaya. And thank you to my partner, who flew out here for this show and also held my hand through all of the birthing and postpartum experience, Andy, over there. Give him a hug. Thank you all for coming out. The last thing I want to say is thank you to all the storytellers one more time for doing what you did up here tonight. I hope you all have a wonderful night. Go out, share the stories, keep talking about this, keep collaborating, and let's change Arkansas for the better. Thank y'all.